On Sunday, February 19th at 11 p.m., Shug and My Bowl presents John Else, author of True South, Henry Hampton, and Eyes on the Prize, the landmark television series that reframed the civil rights movement. Join us as we discuss Henry Hampton and the process of making Eyes on the Prize as we help keep this listener-supported experiment alive. That's Sunday, February 19th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Shug and My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening is John Else. John Else is the author of True South, Henry Hampton, and Eyes on the Prize, the landmark television series that reframed the civil rights movement. And we're offering this book for a pledge of $35 this evening, and you can get your autographed copy of True South by calling 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Or you can go to give2wbai.org, and that's for your generous support of $35. We will thank you with this autographed copy of True South by John Else. John Else, Sugar in My Bowl, Joyce Jones, coming up now.
I want some sugar in my bowl. I want some sugar in my bowl.
Keep your eyes on the prize, oh, Lord. Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
John Else.
John Else, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Joyce, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. I'm always happy when I'm speaking to someone from Pacifica Radio.
Oh, yay! And for those who aren't aware, John Else is the author of True South, Henry Hampton, and Eyes on the Prize, the landmark television series that reframed the civil rights movement. That's the complete title, isn't it?
That was not my idea. You know, you learn a lot of things when you write a book, and one of the things you learn is that the publisher is completely in charge of the title, and they have all sorts of reasons that have to do with Google and the Internet and searches that they come up with these preposterous long titles.
I see.
It gets the job done.
Oh, great.
I guess.
Well, thank you so much for joining Sugar My Bowl.
Sure. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, I read in the beginning of the book, you mentioned how there was no real plan to have this book. You did not intend to write this book. So how did you wind up writing it?
I never intended to write a book, and I did it for several reasons. The main reason I set out to write a book was that I had been involved with Henry Hampton. I had been involved with Eyes on the Prize, and it was an amazing experience. It was an amazing chapter in American storytelling. His company, Blackside Incorporated, was just an astonishing institution in Boston. And I assumed that someone was writing a book to preserve the legacy and to provide an operating manual for folks in the future on how to do this. How do you go back and look at these contested histories, and how do you tell them, and how do you fold in all kinds of voices, and how do you make them accurate, and how do you build an institution of young filmmakers, particularly young filmmakers of color, that can tell these stories? So it turned out no one was doing it. And a lot of the people involved with making Eyes on the Prize and the other films that Henry did were aging. You know, people were getting into their 70s and 80s. And I was just afraid that the story was going to slip away. So I'd spent my life making documentary films. And they're really hard to make. These big, giant documentaries are really difficult. They cost a lot of money. They kind of almost ruin your life for a couple of years whenever you do them. So I figured that writing any book had to be easier than making any film. It turned out that was wrong, but at least when I started out, I thought it was going to be easy. So it took about 4 years. I began the book the week that Barack Obama was reelected by a big margin, and the book went to the printer the week that Donald Trump was elected. So it was a long, strange journey, I'll tell you.
Oh, goodness. Was the process of your writing this book, was it similar to how you describe working on Eyes on the Prize?
No, not at all. I mean, it's similar in some ways to big documentaries because we're telling a narrative. Humans kind of want stories that have beginnings and middles and then some kind of resolution, and they like central characters. And so in that way, writing a book is similar to doing a film. But you can pack so much more into a book. For example, the first film I ever did, a big epic documentary about the atomic bomb, was called The Day After Trinity. And somebody published a bootleg book of that film. They got the whole thing into 25 pages. It was really a pamphlet. And you could fit all 6 episodes of Eyes on the Prize 1 into about maybe 100 pages if you just did the dialogue. So that's the big difference, is that you really can jam an enormous amount of factual material in. On the other hand, books are kind of, compared to films, they're emotionally sort of empty in an odd way. For instance, I wrote in True South, there's a big section on freedom songs.
She been a beauty, even we. No, we'll never change.
incredible songs that we sang in church in the South at mass meetings and at demonstrations. And they had so much power. I mean, you know, we would walk into cannon fire with enough freedom songs. So I described that on the page, and I talked about Bernice Johnson Reagan and Sweet Honey in the Rock and some of these great singers in Selma, Alabama, Betty May Fikes. And I got done with it, and it's just kind of words on the page. But if you can hop on Google or put on Eyes in the Prize and you can listen to 1 minute of people in a congregation in Albany, Georgia in 1962 singing those songs, it's transforming. I mean, it has such incredible power. So there are pros and cons. I'm glad I did both. I hope to continue doing both. I think you need both books and films, frankly, all kinds of nonfiction media, to have a productive national conversation.
You mentioned the Freedom Songs, and actually one of the scenes that stood out for me when I watched Eyes on the Prize 1 was Fannie Lou Hamer.
Oh, tell it on the mountain, over the hill and everywhere.
Let my people go.
Let my people go.
Go tell it on the mountain.
Yeah, she's standing there at the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey in 1964, and the Democratic Party has just refused to accept the Mississippi Freedom Delegation.
Right.
You know, it's interesting you bring up Fannie Lou Hamer, because one of the things that Henry Hampton wanted to do, he was determined to do, was to show that the civil rights movement was driven from below as much as it was driven from above. It was driven by ordinary people like Fannie Lou Hamer. She worked on a plantation, she had minimal education, and yet she rose to be just an amazing leader of this movement. And Henry was very worried that by the time he got to making Eyes on the Prize in the early 1980s, the civil rights movement had been reduced to sort of the eloquence of Dr. King and then a bunch of mad dog sheriffs and police chiefs with the dogs and the fire hoses. And he wanted to bring the maids and the cooks and the janitors and the farmhands and the sharecroppers who, with tremendous courage, went in the streets and made this thing happen. And he was convinced that they were being overlooked and that understanding them was important to future liberation struggles and was important to future storytelling. And Fannie Lou Hamer was only one of those. You know, even Dr. King, we forget that in Montgomery, Alabama, where the bus boycott began, was cooked up by local people, you know,
right,
mostly local women, actually, in 1955. Dr. King was a local dude. He was an unknown young minister who had just finished his degree, and he had come down to Montgomery to be a pastor, to mm-hmm. minister to his flock. And he got swept away in this boycott and soon became its leader, and, of course, the rest is history. That is a great example of a movement that rose entirely from the people in Montgomery, tens of thousands of people walking to work for a year.
Now, when did you get involved with the production of Eyes on the Prize? At what point were you dragged in?
Well, it didn't take much dragging.
Okay.
I had worked in the South in the 1960s in the movement. I had been in Mississippi and in Alabama. And then I went on to become a documentary filmmaker and a cameraman. And it's interesting. I was actually working on a big science series for public television in 1984 and 85. And I was doing second unit, the special effects work on a Tom Cruise movie called Top Gun.
Oh, wow.
And I heard about this guy in Boston. I never heard of this fellow named Henry Hampton, who was doing a series about the civil rights movement. And I thought, wow, that, you know, I'd like to be involved in that. So I somehow got a phone number, and, you know, I dialed the phone number, and this friendly guy answered, and it was Henry Hampton. I mean, I discovered later that I could hear all these phones ringing in the background, and I discovered later that it was Henry Hampton's company. It was just Henry Hampton. It was just him and a whole bunch of unanswered telephones.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. You know, he said, look, if you're in Boston, come on by and we'll talk. You know, we've already hired all our staff. So I was in Boston about a month later meeting with public television about the science series, and I stopped by what was called school. Henry had this operation where he brought all the filmmakers and activists from the 1960s and a lot of historians. He brought them all together for about a 10-day session of, you know, arguing and debating and studying and doing assigned readings. So I showed up, and I walked in the back of the room, big conference room, and there were about 30 people there, and they were watching a piece of old news film, and it happened that it was the attack on the Pettus Bridge. It was when the Alabama State Troopers attacked 600 unarmed men, women, and children, led by John Lewis and Hosea Williams. And I had been on the staff of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and John Lewis's office was right down the hall from mine. And I walked into this room, and I saw the police beating John unconscious. And I just decided right there in the dark that I had to work on this series. I decided I had to quit the public television science series.
Wow.
And whoever this guy Henry Hampton was, I wanted to work with him. So when the lights came on, we met for the first time. We went out for a drink that night, and he hired me on the spot. And then the next morning, he introduced me to his startled production team as the new guy on the team. And I worked with him for about the next 10 years on Eyes on the Prize and a number of other projects.
When talking about Eyes on the Prize, I mean, I remember when I watched it, there were two parts.
Yes, thank you. People forget that Eyes on the Prize is not just the first six programs about sort of the golden age of civil rights, but it in total is 14 programs, and
right,
it covers the period from the very early days of the murder of Emmett Till and the original school desegregation case in 1954, and it goes all the way through Birmingham, Alabama, and Selma, Alabama, and Mississippi, and it goes up through Malcolm X and the shift after 1965 and the events in Selma, the shift toward black power and black nationalism. And it covers Muhammad Ali. It covers the last year of Dr. King's life and his assassination. It covers their incredible stories about what happened on black college campuses
right
in the 1970s. There are stories about the urban rebellions
right
in the late 60s and 1970s. In fact, you know, I'm coming back to New York on February 25th, and at the Brooklyn Museum, we're going to have a screening. We're going to show episodes from Eyes on the Prize covering the whole span. We're going to show the very first episode and the very last episode, and then four other episodes in between, including one that covers, I believe, we're doing the Attica Prison Rebellion, the rise of black power, Malcolm X. We'll do Selma. We're going to do the Mississippi Summer. And in fact, I'm going to be joined by Sam Pollard,
yes,
who was the producer on Eyes 2,
mm-hmm,
which was the second part that Henry did.
Right. And there's someone else who's going to be there.
The producer of a fantastic new film called Whose Streets Are Streets.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I believe there's an investigative reporter from The Times who's going to be there. Yeah, we're going to have a big panel discussion about it. So if you have a real hankering for Eyes on the Prize, that's your day. You can binge-watch Eyes on the Prize, and you can hear all of us talk about what we did right and what we did wrong.
The panel, I think, is scheduled in the afternoon.
Yes, that's correct.
It's from 2 to 3 or something like that?
Yep, exactly.
But
I think the screening started at 11, I think.
Right,
like that.
Right. And that's at the Brooklyn Museum.
Yes, the Brooklyn Museum. Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. If you go back and look at Eyes on the Prize now, in some ways it looks like a fossil. It's a sort of funky old, you know, thing. But in other ways, it's just like it was made yesterday.
Yes.
I marvel at particularly some of the episodes in Eyes 2 are so fresh and so relevant in a way that we never, never could have expected back then.
I want to also make clear that the moderator is New York Times staff writer Nicole Hannah-Jones.
That's who it is, Nicole Hannah-Jones. Thank you.
Yeah, yes. She actually had an amazing book about segregated schools, pretty much.
Yes.
And
yes.
It's happening right yes. now. So.
Happening right now.
Right.
Well, you know, I mean, tell me about it. Segregated schools, segregated housing.
Right, right, exactly. And the filmmaker whom you've referenced is Sabah Foloyan.
Yeah, I saw that film at the Sundance Film Festival, uh-huh. and I can testify it's breathtaking.
I actually plan to be at this event, so I can hear the panel and get you to autograph several books.
Oh, I'll autograph, you know, for you and all your friends. As many as you want. I went to author autograph school.
No.
I learned which page. Well, the publisher teaches you all this stuff.
Sure.
Know, which page to do it on. Be sure you have the person write down their name on a pad of paper so you get the spelling right.
Oh, my goodness. So you're a pro. You're a complete pro
well,
at this now.
I'm an inspired amateur.
Right. There was an event that I think was at Joe's Pub.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And that was earlier this month? I mean,
that was earlier this month, yeah. Right. That was actually an event, an internal event put on by the Ford Foundation.
Right.
And they invited a bunch of Blackside alumni.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got to give a shout-out for the Ford Foundation, which, you know, it's no secret that documentary films are incredibly difficult to fund. They're
mm-hmm.
incredibly expensive. You know, it may surprise you that,
yes.
you know, the average big documentary film costs about $1 million, $500,000. If you go home tonight and you turn on HBO or Netflix or PBS and you see an hour-long documentary, it's a good bet that was at least $500,000. And when Henry Hampton set out to make Eyes in the Prize, not only was documentary difficult to fund, documentaries about the African-American experience were almost impossible to fund.
Right.
He tried it first on commercial television. It was a complete failure. He went down in flames.
Mm.
Then he rebooted it. He had such conviction in the project that he got it going in public television. And one of the very, very first and one of the very strongest supporters was the Ford Foundation. So now, 30 years later, we had a big party.
Right.
Paid for by the Ford Foundation. We had a brass band, actually.
Right.
I said it was the party we always wanted to have at Blackside, but we could never afford it.
Right.
We had this incredible... Oh, what was the name of the band? It was a hip-hop brass band.
Well, I actually caught some video on YouTube of the event,
oh,
so it's actually
okay.
up there.
Oh, it is. Okay. Pitch Black Brass Band.
That's it.
At the party at Joe's Pub, we had the Pitch Black Brass Band, which is a hip-hop brass band, and it was just the greatest thing I've ever experienced around Blackside, because they did a brass band version of the theme song, Eyes on the Prize. And they did a bunch of hip-hop stuff with a tuba and trombones and this great rapper. I mean, it was great.
And actually, I know the tuba player. She's a
oh, she's
wonderful
great.
Person. Yes.
Oh, tell her she's got a fan in
okay.
the author.
Okay, will do.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, she sings also.
Ah, oh, I've not heard her sing, but I've
yeah, yeah.
definitely heard her play tuba.
Chips like gas, Nazareth, I messed up, homie, you messed yeah. up, but if I go acting, we gon' be alright, we gon' be alright, we gon' be alright, we gon' be alright, did you hear me, did you feel me, we gon' be alright, we gon' be alright, we gon' be alright, we gon' be alright, do you hear me, do you feel me? A black man only seeing Brooklyn Hope get shot in South Carolina, choked in New York. Modern day, it's a politician's stove. Hanging people off the job of Novo. You can get it either way. If you're rich or you're broke, when your complexion is a shade of smoke. Maybe it's a shade of khaki. Maybe you brush your hair. Maybe you're just wearing nappy. America always trying to make me happy. Here's a candy. Here's a basket. Put your dreams in. This is magic. Whatever you want, you can't have that. I grab the basket. Took my dreams back and reap what you sow. Now I got green grass. Underdog coming up real fast. Not knowing what happened if Jack never took those beans back. And you know we've been hurting down before. When our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go?
Go, go!
And we hate football, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure.
Sure.
I'm at the preacher's door.
Come on.
Knees get weak and my gun might blow.
But
we gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Come on. Have a stay shot like a cactus. Then I had to kill it like a cost to the black kids. I can't breathe. Black lives matter. But it doesn't change who the cops coming after. They see the hair and they expect that I gotta kill it with a weapon and they have to check. I mean, for my rights, they have no respect. Caught up before the wall if they want the check. I was a born to a spoon lynch like the privileged kids who can fit about the gifts they got for Christmas. Then it broke, don't know the half. Rich chick always wanna claim middle class. Anything she needs, she want, ain't gonna ask. Tell these little girls what a task is big cash. Poor is getting poorer and the rich is getting richer. Don't work. We work it out, my people, and you know we've been hurt, been down before. When our power was lost, looking at the world like, where do we go? And we hate poor, wanna kill us dead in the streets for sure. Come on, I'm at the preacher's door, my knees get weak. God, I don't think we gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you see me? We gon' be alright. Come on, we gon' be alright.
Come on,
we gon' be alright. Come on, we gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? Do we be alright?
Yeah.
Come on, we gon' be alright.
Come on,
we gon' be alright.
Come on,
we gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright.
Let's hear you say that. Come on. Let's hear your voices.
We gon' be alright. Did you hear me? Did you feel me? We gon' be alright. Come on, NYC. Come on, NYC. Come on, NYC.
Come on.
Did you hear me? Did you feel me? We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Did you hear me? Did you feel me? We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Did you hear me? Did you feel me? We gon' be alright. NYC.
We're Pitch Black Brass Band.
Pitch Black.
Eyes on the prize.
The way you broke down the book, how did you decide how you were going to do this? It's not exactly in chronological order. As a matter of fact, I appreciate the way it sort of starts in the introduction.
Sure.
Or author's notes, actually. No, it was the introduction. It was somewhere in the beginning where you mention how desperate the condition Henry Hampton was in at the moment.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. You know, constructing this book was complicated for me because, you know, I'm a journalist and, you know, we try to be dispassionate and we try to stick to the facts and I hope I did all that, but I was also part of the story because I had been involved in some of the events in Eyes on the Prize. I mean, you can find me in some of the newsreel footage, actually, from the 1960s, if you
know
where
to
look.
That's right. There's actually a picture of you in the book.
Yeah, exactly. I had been involved in the Civil Rights Movement. I had also been very involved in the making of Eyes on the Prize. So when I started out, I had not planned to put myself in the story. I had planned to simply do a chronological kind of dry survey of Henry Hampton's 10-year struggle to get this thing made. And it seemed in a way kind of dishonest not to put my own experiences in there because I had lived through so much of it. And also because of my relationship with Henry Hampton over the years, I had a lot of kind of inside information. So that was the decision I made, that I was going to tell the story of making Eyes on the Prize. I was going to tell through that also some of the story of the Civil Rights Movement and then some of my own history. Now, when I make films, I very often open the film with a moment in which everything condenses into one kind of little stick of dynamite, you know, one really, really important moment that kind of shines the light on all the rest of it. And for me, when I was making Eyes on the Prize, it was that night when Henry Hampton picked me up at the airport in Boston in the middle of winter. It was freezing cold. We were in the middle of making Eyes on the Prize. We were running out of money, and we drove around Boston in this horrible, miserable, freezing rain. I remember Henry had Archie Shepp playing on the, he had an 8-track in his old Jaguar, and we drove around and, you know, had a bite to eat. And that night we talked about his experiences in Selma, Alabama in 1965, 30 years before, and I had been in Selma also in 65. So later that night, around midnight, we went back to the office, and he climbed up the stairs to his office, and he had probably 100 rejection letters from foundations saying they weren't going to give him money. And he knew, and he told me that night, that we were out of money. We didn't have enough money to meet payroll the next month, so we were going to have to shut down Eyes on the Prize and leave it for someone else to do, you know, sometime in the future. So we called it a night, folded up the rejection letters, and the next morning he came to the office about noon, and he told me he had gone to his bank and he had mortgaged his house to meet the payroll to keep Oz and the Prize going. And he managed to keep things going for about 3 weeks or a month until there was a big grant from the Ford Foundation and another one from public television that came in. Tax money, by the way. You know, you guys, you paid for Oz and the Prize.
Yay!
So he was that kind of guy, you know. He was a guy who, he knew that if we shut the doors that his life stream would end forever. That would be it. And I don't recommend mortgaging your house to finish a television program. I don't think, I would never have done it, you know, but Henry did, and that's, I guess, what kept it alive.
Now, in my having read that, I was wondering, did that come back to bite him, or everything worked out as a result?
Well, you know, that moment was, it was so Henry Hampton, because it was just so full of passion to get this story told.
Right.
And it was also, a complete job of kind of lousy management.
Yeah. You know?
And it was, the reason I chose to open with that is that that was the moment when I realized that no one in corporate America and no one in Foundation America wanted to pay for the story of African American liberation on television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was just like a non-starter until those two foundations stepped up. So, in a way, it was not the last time Henry mortgaged his house to keep the series going. He did it, I found out from the financial people and the accountants later on, that he did it a couple more times. You know, one of Henry's close friends, a wonderful woman named Ellen Sweets, who's a journalist.
And you write about Ellen Sweets.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, she was a childhood friend. She went on to be a wonderful journalist in Dallas at the Dallas Morning News. And Ellen said, show me a great artist who's a great manager. And, you know, I had to admit that, you know, I started doing a list of great artists, James Brown and Willie Nelson and, you know, Van Gogh and Picasso and James Baldwin. And these guys are all, they're all, you know, terrible managers.
Right.
You know, Lena Horne.
Right,
know,
right. Yeah.
You know, Nina Simone.
Oh, yeah. Others,
you know, you know, they're, you know, now that doesn't, I don't think you have to be a bad manager if you're a great artist.
No.
But in the case of Henry Hampton, the two did not go together. Now, fortunately, as time went on, Henry had the good sense to hire some very, very good people who helped him run the company. And but in the end, over the 20 years of that company's heyday, there were so many stories about the black experience in America that Henry felt just had to be told, that he kind of said, damn the torpedoes, we're going to tell these stories, and if we don't have the cash in hand, we're going to tell the stories anyway. We're going to go out and interview these people before they die. We're going to get these stories on the screen. We're going to hire editors and researchers. We're going to get this stuff in-house and get it done. And if we end up in debt for doing it well, that's tough. You know, we'll pay off the debt with the next series. And that's very often exactly what happened. It paid my salary. It got what may be the greatest body of work about the African-American experience on television. It's what made that happen.
Sure.
I think things are different now. You know, I hope things are different now. If you look, for instance, at the documentary landscape now, I mean, you know, there are an awful lot of producers and directors of color, an awful lot of African-Americans now making very high-profile, really great films. That was not the case when Henry started.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Remember, no applause, and keep it down. Your drinks, don't rattle your ice in your glasses, and don't ring the cash register. You got it covered? All right. I'd like to continue this set with a composition dedicated to the first or second or third All-American heel, Faubus, and it's titled Fables of Faubus. Oh, Lord, don't let them shoot us. Oh, Lord, don't let them stab us. Oh, Lord, don't let them torn feather us. Oh, Lord, no more swastikas. Then he's a fool. Oh. Annie Richmond? Oh, why are they so sick and ridiculous? The brainwash and teach you
listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar and My Bowl's the name of this program. Our guest for this evening is John Else. He is the author of True South, Henry Hampton, and Eyes on the Prize, the landmark television series that reframed the civil rights movement. John Else has been sharing information about the process of filming, documenting the civil rights movement, and working with Henry Hampton, whose brainchild it was to present Eyes on the Prize on broadcast television. What you're listening to right now is original Faubus Fables from Charles Mingus that was recorded on Charles Mingus Presents Charles Mingus, a 1961 Candid Records release. Candid Records was Nat Hentoff's label. This was released in 1961. Charles Mingus on bass and vocals, Eric Dolphy on alto saxophone, bass clarinet, Danny Richmond on drums and vocals, Ted Kirsten on trumpet. Before that, we heard Kendrick Lamar's All Right from the band called Pitch Black. They performed at an Eyes on the Prize True South event that was hosted by the Ford Foundation. That was arranged by T.J. Robinson, and you can find out more about T.J. Robinson, who's a member of Pitch Black, at tjrmusik.com. That's tjrmusik.com. Before that, we heard Tender Warriors from Max Roach, Percussion Bittersweet, Impulse Records 1962, Booker Little on trumpet, Julian Priester on trombone, Eric Dolphy on alto sax, bass clarinet and flute, Clifford Jordan on tenor sax, Mal Waldron on piano, Art Davis on bass, Max Roach on drums, Carlos Potato Valdez on conga, and Carlos Tatico Eugenio on cowbell. Before that, we heard Fannie Lou Hamer's interpretation of Go Tellin' on the Mountain. This is, and the previous song, We'll Never Turn Back, is from the Voices of the Civil Rights Movement, the Black American Freedom Songs, 1960-1966. This is a 1997 on the Smithsonian Folkways label. We'll Never Turn Back is the SNCC Freedom Singers, led by Emory Harris. Before that, we heard Eyes on the Prize, also by the Pitch Black Band, from the celebration that took place in February at Joe's Pub. And I'd also like to take this moment, not sure whether she's listening, but Janelle Critchlow, who is the tuba player in Pitch Black, I'd like to say hello and thank you for your assistance. Eyes on the Prize, by the way, was arranged by Ben Brody, and you can find out more about Ben Brody's arrangements and work at BenBrodyMusic.com. And we opened our show with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl.
The compilation is called The Very Best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This was originally recorded in 1967. This is a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for our associate producer Hank Williams and his On the Bandstand segment on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
fascists approve. Boobs who crush land with your Jim Crow.
A handful. That's ridiculous, Daddy. Oh, why are they so sick and ridiculous, Daddy? Brainwash and teach you a.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for February 19th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's show features John Else, author of the book True South, Henry Hampton and Eyes on the Prize. You can see him at the Brooklyn Museum on February 25th as part of a panel discussion on the Eyes on the Prize series. WBAI Radio is also starting its winter fun drive, and we need your help to support the station. You can do that by calling 516-620-3602 while we're on the air, or pledge online at give2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org. You can give as little as $5, but $25 gets you a year's station membership, or consider a monthly donation, which gets you a station membership as a WBAI buddy with additional benefits. We also have a few autographed copies available of John Else's True South book as a thank you gift at the $35 pledge level at 516-620-3602. I'll repeat all that info at the bottom of the segment after our music listings. We start this week with percussionist Mino Cinello, who's at the Blue Note on the 20th with the Loop Loft All-Stars. Bassist Christian McBride is at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem to talk about his recording career for part two of the Session Stories on the 20th, and he'll be performing at the Town Hall on the 23rd. Saxophonist Ravi Coltrane leads a quartet at the Jazz Standard from the 21st to the 26th. Flutist Bobby Humphrey presents Harlem River Drive at Ginny's Supper Club on the 21st for two sets. Pianist Vijay Iyer is at the Jazz Gallery with Henry Threadgill and Daphnis Prieto on the 22nd and 23rd, and at the Ecstatic Music Festival on March 4th. Guitarist Mark Rebo is at Sonny's in Red Hook, Brooklyn on the 23rd. Hammond B3 organ master Dr. Lonnie Smith leads a trio at Long Island University Brooklyn's Cumble Theater on the 25th. Vocalist Carol Maillard is with Sweet Honey and the Rock at Kane University's Enloe Recital Hall in Hillside, New Jersey on the 26th. Blues vocalist Alexis P. Suter is at the Falcon in Marlboro, New York with the Ministers of Sound on the 26th and on March 4th. Looking ahead to March, saxophonist Sweet Papa Lou Donaldson is at the Blue Note from the 2nd through 5th. Saxophonist Oliver Lake, drummer Andrew Surreal, and guitarist Mark Rebo are all at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Appel Room with Dave Douglas's Metamorphosis on March 3rd and 4th. Drummer and percussionist Will Calhoun is at Carnegie Hall with Living Color on the 6th, performing the music of Aretha Franklin. Saxophonist Gary Bartz is at the Blue Note on the 6th with pianist McCoy Tyner. Harpist Brandy Younger is at the Schomburg Center on the 6th for the annual Women in Jazz Festival. Drummer Terry Lynn Carrington is there on the 13th for the same series. Finally, vibraphonist Gary Burton is at Birdland from the 7th through the 11th. That's all this week. If you've missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website, and Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge at 516-620-3602 while we're on the air, or pledge online at give2wbai.org, or see the Support WBAI link on our website. Remember, you can give as little as $5 or $25 for a year's station membership, and pledges at the $35 level will get you an autographed copy of John Else's True South book as a thank you gift. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our bi-weekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, March 5th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio and online at WBAI.org.
The role of media in a democratic society should be to empower people to make decisions.
WBAI, speaking truth to power for over 50 years.
You have very few powerful media outlets that are actually doing the two things that I think are the most central aims of good journalism, which is to give voice to the voiceless and hold those in power accountable.
WBAI, your community alternative.
Well, several of those filmmakers came out of Blackside, and I know you should go into that as well.
Yeah, there are five documentary films nominated for Best Documentary Feature for the Oscars this year, and four of them are directed by African Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And three of them are about the Civil Rights Movement. So
right.
It's no secret that in these days, you know, we're looking for tiny little signs of hope, and I see that as not a tiny sign, but a big sign that maybe Henry got something started with Eyes on the Prize. Maybe it would have happened anyway, but the good thing is that it's happened.
Right. the role of women at Blackside. I actually, in hearing the event that happened at Joe's Pub, Judy Richardson.
Sure.
And Judith...
Vecchione.
Vecchione, yeah. They talked about their experience. What was your knowledge of the inclusion of women?
Well, you know, I'm a white guy, mm-hmm. you know, and I mean, I have a lot of experience being a white male,
right.
And we don't notice stuff. You know? Now, fortunately, I was raised by a feminist mother way back in the 1950s, and so I became aware, partly from talking to the women, that Henry was not a feminist.
Right.
His father was not a feminist.
No.
His mother was not a feminist. He was a chauvinist in both the good and bad sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he liked to pull the ladies' chair out at lunch, and he liked to... The ladies got flowers and perfume on Valentine's Day at the office. But he also, in meetings, he would call on me first, even though I was... There were plenty of women who were senior to me.
Mm-hmm.
Both Judith Vecchione and Judy Richardson were senior to me, but very often I would get called on first. So every institution has its gender issues.
Sure, of course.
And I think to pretend otherwise is, you know, foolish. And every institution has its ethnic and race issues.
Right.
And at Blackside, at least they could be discussed. Certainly race was discussed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, endlessly, both, you know, because we were doing a film about the movement and also because the staff was... It was about half black, about half white, about half women, about half men. And Henry was just determined that he was going to run his company that way. It was going to be a mix. It was going to look like, I won't say it was going to look like America. It was going to look like the audience that he wanted to reach with his films. That was what mattered for him. And he, particularly the mix of men and women, he loved what he called the abrasion of good minds.
What does that mean?
Well, that meant that, you know, on a good day, you'd have aging white men like me, and you'd have young black women like Meredith Woods, and you could argue about something.
Uh-huh.
You know, you could argue about, well, we've got this march that we're making a movie about, and there are white people in the march marching with African Americans, and then there are white people on the sidelines yelling at the white people in the march. How do the white people in the march feel? And how do the black people in the march feel? And those discussions, you know, I don't know anywhere else in a television production company where those discussions actually happened and where people actually became, as far as I could tell, became comfortable having those discussions. Now, there was a limit. Judy Richardson explained to me that, you know, Henry wanted black people to have to explain to white people, and he wanted white people to have to explain to black people. He said, we have secrets from each other. We have secrets across race. We have secrets across gender, across generations. And Judy Richardson said, look, you know, there's a time when you get sick of explaining yourself.
Right.
And so, you know, the black staff actually, without Henry's knowledge, had a black 4th of July party one year, something that Henry would never have approved. So, you know, I'm, in a way, I guess I'm sort of the wrong guy to ask about
okay.
the role of women. There's a great line from Marshall McLuhan. Yeah, Marshall McLuhan said, you know, no one knows who discovered water, but it certainly was not a fish. And no one knows who first named racism, but it was certainly not white men.
Right.
It's all over now, yeah. Old Jim Crow.
Judy Richardson. She's great, by the way. She's sort of the voice of Eyes on the Prize. She's probably done more public appearances, and she's just a ball of fire. I met Judy 50 years ago in Mississippi.
Doing civil rights work?
She was on the staff of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and I actually was in Atlanta, Georgia. I arrived by bus from California to begin my job at the SNCC headquarters in Atlanta and went to the Freedom House, and Judy Richardson's the one who met me at the door. I've never forgotten that laugh.
Great. You know, I asked you about the chapter titles and how you decided, but I don't think we talked about that. Some of the titles actually were used in the series. How did you decide that these were the titles you would use?
I decided the book is structured more or less chronologically. It's loaded up with flashbacks and some flash forwards, but mainly it follows through sort of the making of Eyes on the Prize, which actually happens to follow the civil rights movement from the beginning up through about 1980. And some of the titles are taken right from Henry's work. Like he did, the very first film he ever made was a public service spot called The Gun Spot, which had a little blonde 6-year-old kid with a pistol. And it had a tagline, racism is like a loaded gun. So that's pulled right out of Henry's own work. Some of the titles are pieces of philosophy that I got from Henry. You know, Henry was a great patriot, and he insisted that we put lots of American flags in Eyes on the Prize. And it's no secret that his staff was all, you know, kind of lefty, progressive folks. You know, he tried to get, he got one kid that he hired away from the Reagan White House. But otherwise, you know, pretty much everyone was progressive and activist, and we didn't like the idea of a lot of American flags. But Henry made a very persuasive argument. He said, look, this is our flag, too. Don't let them take this flag away. Don't let the right wing take this flag away.
To say it's my country. Before they give in,
they'd rather fuss and fight
than say it's my country. I paid 300 years or more of slave driving sweat and welts on my back. This is my country. Too many have died in protecting my pride for me to go second class. We've survived the hard blow, and I want you to know that you'll face us at last. And I know you will give consideration. Shall we perish unjust or live equal as a nation? This is my country. And I know you will give consideration. Shall we perish unjust or live equal as a nation? This is my country.
So that's one of the chapters. It's our flag, too. And
exactly.
That speaks sort of to his... He had the best kind of patriotism. It's easy to be cynical now about patriotism, but it's also easy to forget that patriotism can mean, as it did for Henry, just a deep, 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 deep belief in what you learned in high school civics about equity and equality and, you know, the orderly process of government.
Right.
All that stuff that seems to be... in jeopardy now.
Well, it's also the thing that a lot of people aren't learning civics in the way that they did when Henry Hampton was in school.
I mean, we have a president who clearly has no idea what happened in Selma, Alabama in 1965.
Right.
And you know, I don't demand that all Americans know what happened in Selma in 65, but I demand that my president knows that.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, I think that this book has come in just the right time for people as a reminder of information, of struggles, of what we have to do now. It just seems to be the right time. Did you plan that it coincide with the anniversary of Eyes on the Prize? It's the 30 years now.
We did plan. Publishers always look for events. 30th anniversary was kind of a nice little tag for it. I never in a million years would have predicted that Donald Trump would be our president when this book came out. And when I started the book, I thought that it would be in some ways irrelevant in a really good way, that Dr. King talked about the arc of the moral universe and how it bends toward justice. And it seemed to me when I began the book that throughout my lifetime, I've seen a lot of America over the years, and throughout my lifetime, the arc of the moral universe, in fact, did sort of bend toward justice. America was on this sort of drunken walk through most of my lifetime. But it was a walk that generally moved toward justice and toward greater equality and toward the expansion of democracy. But suddenly, I'm not so sure. When the book finally came out, I thought it would be irrelevant because a lot of these battles were on their way to eventually being won. Maybe not in my lifetime. And when the book came out, it was almost irrelevant in a different way, that it seemed that so many of these battles now, we have to fight them all over again.
Right.
The legacy of Martin Luther King slammed up against the legacy of George Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
And that's tough for us. I think a lot of people who came out of the movement were sort of glass half full kind of people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the glass right now is kind of half full of poison, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always enjoy playing Washington, D.C. Makes me feel not only among friends, but close to the seat of government. Provides me with an opportunity to deliver, for example, this open letter pressed into my hands by a man on my street. If I'm not mistaken, I once read, back during that short spell I spent in school, where every slave set free was supposed to get, for slaving, 40 acres and a mule. Now, ain't no telling how much work was done by my ancestors under slavery's rule, but sure as hell the total got to run at least 40 acres and a mule. Now, I'm not saying this to see folks sweat, because I'm not bitter, neither am I cruel. But ain't nobody paid for slavery yet about my 40 acres and my mule. We had a promise. That was taken back. When we hollered, it was hush, be cool. Well, me, I'm being rowdy, hot, and black. I want my 40 acres and my mule. Don't tell me not to get myself upset. Don't look at me like I'm some kind of ghoul. Just answer quietly, when do I get my goddamn 40 acres and my mule? No thanks, I'll take my own self out to lunch. No thanks, I'll dig me my own swimming pool and lay and play around with my own bunch. Yeah. I get 40 acres and a mule. Cause interest gotta go on, just like rent. I may be crazy, but I ain't no fool. 100 years of debt at 10% per year, per 40 acres and per mule. Now,
jewel. Just pay me that and call the whole thing square. Yes, Lordy, 40 acres and a mule.
Let me say one other thing. The activism of the 1960s worked because if you demonstrated in the streets in Selma, Alabama, there was a moral climate in the White House and in Congress to whom you could appeal.
Right.
If you went up against Bull Connor in Birmingham, Bull Connor didn't give a damn. I mean, he didn't care. He would beat you down until his dying day. But in Congress and in the White House, President Johnson and the Republicans in Congress said, whoa, wait a minute, George Wallace, we're going to come down there and put you in jail if you keep that stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why those demonstrations worked.
Right.
Now, demonstrations, I know, I go to them all, but they are the first step because we do not have a moral center in the White House and we don't have a moral center in control of the Congress. And there's some new strategy that's different from the 1960s. Disruption is not enough.
Right.
Disruption is no longer enough, you know. Rosa Parks could capture the imagination of people up north and she could shame America and shame the Supreme Court into righting an injustice. But Rosa Parks refused to stand up on a bus in Montgomery today. You know, I don't think the White House would give a damn. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's different. Now, there's something else that'll move the White House, and I haven't figured out what it is. I have no doubt that activism will work,
mm-hmm.
But it cannot be your grandpa's activism.
Yeah, no, I've heard people make that line. It's like, this is not your grandmother's or your grandfather's activism.
Yeah.
And
yeah, well, I'm your grandfather, and I'm here to tell you. you know, the movement was very smart in the 1960s, and they were able to find the levers.
Mm-hmm.
That they could pull, and they pulled them they were genius.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were genius to provoke these crazy sheriffs in the South,
mm-hmm.
and then that would shame the nation into passing legislation.
Right.
I think now you provoke a crazy sheriff, and all you do is provoke a crazy sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not that pessimistic.
Right.
I think it's harder to gain the attention of the judiciary or greater forces from outside.
Well, as you mentioned, being provoked is not... You can't just provoke somebody by, you know, being in the street. There really does have to be a stratagem. People have to organize, and it just isn't something that happens in social media. You know, people have to sit down with each other again.
It's really interesting you say that. Yeah, I think you're really onto something there, that we cannot have a movement and we can't have organization without social media, but social media is not enough. There's something about being physically in the same place,
right.
Standing in the rain, with a million other like-minded people. There's something about that that gives you the courage to fight another day. There's
mm-hmm.
something about that in-person soul force of being a whole ton of citizens standing shoulder to shoulder, not clicking shoulder to shoulder, standing
right.
shoulder to shoulder.
Right.
Yeah, there's a great article by Malcolm Gladwell, by the way, from a couple of years ago, about mm-hmm. Judy Richardson, actually. It's an article about Judy Richardson. Yeah. I mean, there's a difference between those young college students who sat in at lunch counters in the early 1960s in the South and organizers now who work just entirely on social media. God bless social media, but I don't think it's enough.
Well, it's a nice introduction, but as you know, you were saying, people standing in the rain, people need to come out of the rain with those people and actually organize for real.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think figuring out what button to push in Washington, what lever to pull, I think that's still, frankly, a work in progress. And I think there are going to be some surprising answers about who is going to hold the line against this new political regime. I was surprised and startled and frankly, really happy to see that the CEO of Google showed up at the airport to protest the immigration ban.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, Sergey Brin. I mean, shout out to Sergey Brin. I mean, that's,
mm-hmm.
you know, who would expect that the head of one of the world's wealthiest corporations would be an activist?
Right.
You know, he is an immigrant.
Yes.
Yep, as are probably a very high percentage of the people working for Google
mm-hmm.
and for Apple and for... I mean, I live in Silicon Valley, and so it's very much... We actually look to these guys now for some sane thinking.
Mm.
I never thought I would.
Amazing.
yours is a music show, right?
It is.
A lot of it. I wanted to talk a little bit about the music in Eyes 1 and Eyes 2.
As did I. Thank you for saying that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The whole Eyes on the Prize epic is 14 episodes long, and it divides pretty starkly right in the middle. The first six shows are about the golden age of civil rights, about sit-ins and boycotts and the marches in Selma and finally the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And those first six episodes are really centered on a civil rights movement that was led by preachers. Mm-hmm. And it was led by parishioners and congregants. It was a church-based movement. And,
right.
And those meetings, all those mass meetings, they all happened in churches. There were tons of churches that were burned and bombed. Clergy were the targets. And the music was music that came largely out of church music in the congregational style, you know, with a song leader. So a lot of old hymns and gospel tunes took out Jesus and put in freedom,
mm-hmm.
and that was the soundtrack for the original civil rights movement. But then when we got up to 1965 and the movement began sort of turning toward electoral politics in the North and turning toward the Black Panthers,
mm-hmm.
and turning toward black nationalism, the music changed. One of our producers, Madison Davis Lacey, said that in Eyes 1, the music made it sound like the preachers were telling the story. And that was, in some ways, true.
Uh-huh.
And in Eyes 2, it's much more hip. All of a sudden, it's Marvin Gaye, and it's Aretha Franklin, and it's early hip-hop. At one point, there was some Afrika Bambaataa in there. It was a lot of urban music from the 1970s and 80s.
And I remember an episode where it ended with a shotgun.
Yes, yes.
That stood in my, oh my gosh.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because the guy singing that song is a fellow named Willie Ricks, who's a SNCC field secretary. And it's a powerful song that is not at all church-based. I mean, it's a completely secular song. And Henry hated that song in Eyes on the Prize. And he tried to get the producers to change that to a freedom song.
Oh, wow.
A gospel-based freedom song.
Hmm.
And the producers, to their credit, said, no, Henry, you know, the movement is leaving the church at this point, and the music is exactly what says that. I'm so glad you picked up on that. Freedom Got a Shotgun, yeah. In the episode about the Meredith March, where Stokely Carmichael introduced the term black power, that actually, at the end of that episode, there is a SNCC field secretary named Willie Ricks, and he's singing a song. Da 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 da. That's it, right?
That's the Night of a Thousand Dances or whatever. Yeah.
That's it.
Right.
That's it. And he's singing, and the words he's singing are, freedom's got a shotgun.
Ah, okay.
And it's, yeah, cool. Freedom is black power, freedom's got a shotgun.
Freedom got a shotgun. Freedom got a shotgun. Freedom got a shotgun. Freedom going to shoot it. Segregated bigots. Freedom got a shotgun.
We'll be right back.
So why didn't he want to use it? I mean, it was because that was what was going on at that time.
Well, Henry was, how can I say this? You know, Henry was trying to serve an awful lot of masters here. Mm-hmm. And Henry knew that this was the one chance that anyone had to get this really fierce, contested story on national television and have it seen by a huge American audience. He wasn't interested in only black people seeing it. He wasn't interested in only white people. He kept saying, what's that white lady in Iowa going to think?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of his people would say, well, I don't give a damn.
But right.
Henry really wanted to reach a broad, broad audience. So he was constantly walking a tightrope between trying to be honest about the ferocity, about the raw edges of the movement, but also not wanting people to change the channel. And I think he felt probably correctly that particularly white Americans and plenty of older middle-class black Americans felt much more comfortable with gospel songs and freedom songs and hymns. And they sure did not feel comfortable with early hip-hop and with very early rap, and they didn't feel comfortable with Marvin Gaye, and they didn't feel comfortable probably with a lot of Motown.
Mm-hmm.
So he was walking that fine line. Now, he never changed things in Eyes on the Prize or in the proposals to please the funders. The only time he ever would sort of back off on things that were really, really sharp and raw was because he didn't want to alienate audiences. And he took a lot of flack for that. He took a lot of flack, particularly from the black scholars that were involved, but he stuck to his guns.
When we're talking about the music, at some point, that became an issue with regard to DVD release.
Yeah. Well, when you make a documentary and you use a song or you use a piece of newsreel footage, you have to pay a license to use that. And they're expensive. The time we did Eyes on the Prize, if you used Happy Birthday,
mm-hmm.
we have a scene in which Martin Luther King's staff sing Happy Birthday to him on what turned out to be his last birthday. That, at the time, was copyrighted, and Happy Birthday, I think it cost about $1,000 to use Happy Birthday in Eyes on the Prize. Now, when you license those songs, if you have a lot of money, you buy a permanent license, and what's called an in perpetuity license for the music, and you can use that Marvin Gaye tune forever. If you don't have a lot of money, like us, you have to license it for a set period. So we bought 10-year licenses for all the newsreel footage, for the music that we used, and Eyes on the Prize was released in 1987, Eyes 1, and then 1990 for Eyes 2. And 10 years out, those licenses began to expire. And at that point, it became technically illegal to broadcast Eyes on the Prize.
Right.
It's as though you look up at the bookshelf in your office, if you still have books, and the books begin to vanish one by one as the quotes in them expire. Now, and it was a huge problem, and more of the music licenses and the newsreel footage licenses expired, and eventually it became illegal to distribute Eyes on the Prize at all. For about 15 years, you could not get Eyes on the Prize because of that problem. And eventually, the Ford Foundation stepped up, and they paid $500,000 to relicense all the archive clips in Eyes on the Prize and release it on DVD. And so now I guess it's safe for the ages, I hope.
Phew. Wow. I always wondered about what happened. What saved it? It was the Ford Foundation.
Well, it was the Ford Foundation. It was also, as it turned out, one of our brilliant young producers, a guy named Orlando Bagwell.
Oh, yes.
Orlando, who did probably the best film ever made about Dr. King, the best film ever made about Malcolm X,
Make It Plain.
He's, you know, Alvin Ailey, Orlando went on to become the head of documentary at the Ford Foundation.
Yes.
And in that capacity, he's the guy, together with a visionary woman named Andrea Taylor, they got together and they decided, Eyes on the Prize, we can't have it unavailable to Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So they researched all the archive footage. They figured out how to relicense it all. There's a whole other story about how the archives had been consolidated. But the success story was that the reason you're able to watch Eyes on the Prize now is that the Ford Foundation came up with $500,000 to pay the owners of all those newsreel footages, those newsreels, and those songs.
That is so incredible and amazing, and we are so grateful. Tell me, is there something that, with regard to Henry Hampton or Eyes on the Prize or just the process of putting this history together, is there something you want to tell the WBAI listeners?
Oh, boy.
Because there's a lot. They could just get the book.
There is a lot. Well, we had a wonderful advisor. We had a guy named Vincent Harding who had worked with Dr. King. Vincent was sort of our house pastor.
very wise man. And Vincent always argued that these stories need to be retold every generation by new storytellers. Mm. And I think he was right. I mean, Eisen the Prize will live on, I hope. And I hope that new generations of citizens and activists and people going into public service and people figuring out how to change things for the better, I hope they'll watch Eisen the Prize and they'll look at that story of how people change things for the better in the end, how people said enough is enough back in the day. But we need filmmakers coming up who are in their 20s and 30s to look at those stories and what's happened since the Civil Rights Movement and tell those stories again. I know that, you know, Henry Hampton founded his company not only to make films, but also to make filmmakers, particularly mm-hmm. to make young black filmmakers.
Right.
And we have people now who are clearly the descendants of Henry Hampton. Mm-hmm. Ezra Edelman comes to mind, who made mm-hmm. O.J., Made in America, is a very clear descendant of Henry's operation there. The people who made Whose Streets Our Streets,
right.
I think, are carrying on the storytelling in a way that Henry would have applauded. He wouldn't agree with all of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would not have made O.J. that way. He would not have made Whose Streets Our Streets, but he would have stood up and shouted out praise for those young ones who were doing it. And for the people who support it.
Well, I just want to remind everyone that on Saturday, February 25th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., there is a celebration of the 30th anniversary of Eyes on the Prize and True South, this book, that is, I'll give the whole title again, True South, Henry Hampton and Eyes on the Prize, the landmark television series that reframed the civil rights movement. There will be screenings of episodes, and there will be a panel discussion from 2 to 3. But come for as long as you like. Stay. It's going to be at the Brooklyn Museum, and that's at 200 Eastern Parkway. In the lovely Republic of Brooklyn. So, and John Else, the author of True South, will be in attendance. So, yay.
So come on out. We might even sing some freedom songs.
Oh, wow. That would be something. And they're good songs to sing, too.
They are good songs to sing. They're not the only songs to sing, but
no.
They're a good place to start.
Right. I actually know some artists who have had sing-alongs. Toshi Regan, Bernice Johnson Regan's
daughter.
Oh, yeah,
Toshi, sure, of course.
She's hosted quite a number of sing-alongs at Joe's Pub. Thank you so much, John Else, for joining Sugar My Bowl.
Thank you, Joyce. This has been a complete delight, and I look forward to being back in Brooklyn.
Oh, wonderful. And get your signing hand ready.
Okay.
All right, John. Have a good night.
Thanks a million, Joyce.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Lift every voice and sing till
you're listening to Sugar in My Bowl on WBAI New York 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening was John Else, who is the author of True South, Henry Hampton, and Eyes on the Prize, the landmark television series that reframed the civil rights movement. And we've been offering this book for your $35 pledge of support. For a pledge of $35, we will be sending you an autographed copy of True South as a thank you gift for your generous support. You can get an autographed copy by calling 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, or going to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. What you're listening to right now is Lift Every Voice and Sing from Kim Weston. That's from the compilation Black Power, Music of a Revolution on Shout Factory Records. It was originally released in 1973 on Stax Records. This compilation was released in 2004. We're going to hear a snippet of a song from Eddie Kendricks after this from this same compilation, My People Hold On. It was originally released on Tamla Motown Records in 1972. We heard Land of a Thousand Dances, that's the name of the title, from Wilson Pickett. This is from a compilation, A Man and a Half, the best of Wilson Pickett. This This is a 1992 Rhino Atlantic compilation. This recording was originally released in 1966. Before that, we heard from the Eyes on the Prize series, Part 7, as a matter of fact, an excerpt that we discussed, Freedom Got a Shotgun. Before that, we heard Back Back from Archie Shepp, and that's from Kwanzaa, which was released in 1974 on Impulse Records. Before that, we heard 40 Acres and a Mule, Oscar Brown Jr., from Mr. Oscar Brown Jr. Goes to Washington, and that was released in 1965 on Verve Records. Before that, we heard Nina Simone, Old Jim Crow is the name of that song, Nina Simone in Concert, 1964 Phillips Records release. Nina Simone on piano, vocals, also arranger, Rudy Stevenson on guitar, Lyle Atkinson on bass, and Bobby Hamilton on drums. Before that, we heard Garvey's Ghost, which included Abby Lincoln. That's from Percussion Bittersweet, Max Roach's release. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa, which is coming up next, right after the snippet from Eddie Kendricks. And give us a call, 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, and show your support for our pledge of $35. If you call during this show, you will receive an autographed copy of True South, the book that we've been discussing this evening by our guest, John Else. Henry Hampton and Eyes on the Prize, the landmark television series that reframed the civil rights movement. Stay tuned. We are scheduled to be back on March 5th on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.